Space burgers, space cavers, space burgers. That's what you decided on. I don't know that I love that, but you voted for it. Maybe we'll do a revote. I don't feel like people walking around going, I'm a space burger, but maybe you are. I like dwellers for some reason. Dwelling in this cave deep in the recesses of space all together. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. How's your 2016 going? That question can't even be considered rhetorical, because I don't know how you're answering. Maybe you'll answer on like Twitter or something, or fire off a message. Anyway, I hope it's going well. Hope it has started productively. I saw some movies recently. Thought I'd fill you in for no reason whatsoever. Just maybe here and there, I will take in the cinema and then report back, and then you can decide for yourself whether you want to go. I'm going to see The Revenant this week. I'll fill you back in. I'll try to remember to fill you back in on that. Hopefully it is good. It looks pretty visually stunning, which my year-end 2015 movie review involves two movies. Mad Max, visually stunning, just a reason to go to the movies and see something that... And maybe the whole landscape of movies is changing, where indie movies and slow movies and even like more comedies, they could just probably go straight to Netflix. There's no real reason to go see things in the theater that don't explode your eyeballs right out of your head. Action movies, big CGI things and whatnot. Maybe that's meant more for that. The surround sound. You might have that in your house, but if you don't, it's nice in the theater. Inside Out, I thought was great. Well-written. Just thoroughly enjoyable. So those are my two movies from 2015 I'd highly recommend. So as you can see, I'm not that passionate about movies or knowledgeable. So feel free to take these reviews with a grain of any particular material that you would like. I saw The Big Short. I would recommend that. It's like an enjoyable documentary. Parts of it in the beginning, the way it's shot, will be annoying. At least they were to me, and then it kind of settles in and it finds its groove. I don't really usually like movies where someone in the movie is talking to me like, hey, it's me, you're going to see me later in the movie. Like, stop talking to me, just be in the movie. And that happens a bit in this movie, but for some reason as it sort of finds its style, it really fits and everything. It's good. Great cast. It has it's one of those things, especially if you are living in the United States and we're curious about how exactly the housing bubble collapsed, does a really thorough job of explaining that and making you feel, you know, it just like disheartened by everything, and then also kind of weirdly uplifted, like, well, at least a couple people tried or were even familiar with what was happening. Yeah, go check that out. What else did I? Oh, saw Star Wars. I feel at this point everyone has seen Star Wars. I'm a little out of the loop on that because I've seen it. I've seen all of them. I saw the original trilogy a few times maybe, but I just don't. It's to me like, it's very similar to the people's love of the Beatles, and I feel like I live on a different planet sometimes where everyone is legitimately, potentially everyone loves Star Wars, loves the Beatles, and then somehow considers themselves a little going against the grain because they love those things. And I feel like that is... what everyone is really into. And so I like them, but I don't have the same sense of, man, I gotta go see this. This is gonna change my life. And I've seen some of the criticism of Star Wars being like, it's exactly like the original one, just with different players in place. There's a new Luke Skywalker, new Han Solo, and a new R2-D2, and they have the exact same storyline as the first one. I can see that. I still liked it. I thought it was enjoyable. I thought... the main girl, who looks just like Keira Knightley Jr., was good. I thought it was well done. So, who cares at all about my response to Star Wars? Everyone has seen it, and if you haven't, Maybe you will at some point, and if you don't want to, don't go see it. And then along those lines, don't go see The Hateful Eight. If you're a huge Quentin Tarantino fan, you go, blah, 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 that's blasphemy. It's the greatest movie. It's one of his masterpieces. I strongly disagree. And I like Quentin Tarantino. I don't like to speak negatively about anything creatively that someone has made, but I feel like in the case of this movie, it's just... I felt like when people were laughing at things, I felt the same way I feel on a Southwest flight when the flight attendant makes some corny joke and people in the back go, they're not called a crackberry, it's a blackberry. I got that joke. I'm with you on that one. It is an infuriating feeling when people are laughing at a joke that you hate. And that's how The Hateful Eight feels. When every character is like kind of a cartoonish, yes, I'm the British guy, and I'll say things like this, isn't that ridiculous? And people in the back, oh, he's being sort of glib about something. That's hilarious. Bothersome on that level. The story is absurd. If you're gonna kill someone who has a hostage and he is alone in a stagecoach and you have five or six people, do it then. Do it out in the open. Why would you go to a lodge and murder everyone in the lodge? And if you're going, hey, man, I haven't seen it. You're spoiling it. I want to spoil it. I'm sick of people saying spoilers. I want to spoil this movie for you. There's no reason for it to be made. It's just Quentin Tarantino kind of falling back on things that people associate him with. Oh, he does like over-the-top violence and brutality. And it's meant in a way to show like that it's supposed to soften it or I don't know what the purpose is. I loved Pulp Fiction, and along the way, the Grindhouse movies, and I liked Kill Bill. I thought Inglourious Basterds was good, but this movie, I mean, you know, he wrote True Romance, and that beating scene in that, where the woman just gets the crap kicked out of her, people went, oh, that says something. It shows us really how graphic these scenes can be, or like how they really are in real life. It's true. Okay, all right. Like that, it's hard to watch. It's hard to take. Seeing a woman be beaten up like that. And then you flash forward to The Hateful Eight, where that seems to be the entire theme of the movie. If you take away the fact that these weirdos have not just attacked the stagecoach, but they're going to murder a bunch of strangers in a lodge and then wait for the stagecoach, which is absurd in itself, then along the way, like, they just... It was... I picture him pitching the movie to people going like, this is what's fun, this is what we like. Okay, we're gonna take this and we're just gonna punch her in the face a bunch. We're gonna knock her teeth out of her head. We're gonna hang her. We're gonna spit on her. We're gonna vomit on her. No one else gets punched in this movie, by the way. Just her, just the woman. She gets beaten up all over like that. And I don't know, do a great Quentin Tarantino. It sounds a lot like Woody Allen. Just oh, we could punch her in the face. But that seems to be how he pitched it to people. Just this weird kind of, why is there no violence to anyone else in the movie? They beat her, they knock her teeth out, they vomit on her, they shoot blood and brains all over her face, they hang her and they laugh and laugh as they're doing it and they lay back. You never see what she did that was terrible. You never get a sense of why she's a horrible person. If anything, she plays the guitar and sings real nice. It's just like he wanted to just beat a woman up. And who knows how that got made or why, but I hated The Hateful Eight, and I never say that. I think if anyone makes something creatively, that's great. That's terrific. I'm glad you did. Again, love Quentin Tarantino. I hope his next thing is different and better, but I did not see the purpose for this. The characters are all just too over the top and makes you like Kurt Russell is fantastic in Tombstone. That is him as a cowboy. Why redo that again? Holster that smoke bag, like that kind of gruff tough. He's that, but it just, it's not, it doesn't seem real. It just seems, not that it should be. It's a movie. I'm really rambling. You guys got worked up about The Hateful Eight. Samuel L. Jackson kind of lost some cool. I mean, he's still cool in the movie, but he's on credit card commercials every 10 seconds. It's hard to think of him as strictly a cool guy from like Pulp Fiction and not just some corporate shill to some degree. So let's move on. Let's move. Don't see The Hateful Eight. Or if you do, wait until you can see it like on a flight or something. And then you'll have this terrific review in your head and go, it wasn't that bad. Maybe it's not. Maybe you like the witty banter. Maybe you like the bizarre characters. But man, those jokes just seem so much like a Southwest Airlines flight to me. And if you haven't been on one of those, you are fortunate. All right, guys, let's get into a conversation, finding out a little bit more about the world. This is with some Eel River Brewing Company's California Blonde Ale with Professor Mysterioso himself. Chris Davidson dropped by. Won't tell you where he teaches, won't tell you what he teaches, but you can, you'll see, he knows a lot about a lot of stuff, very engaging, very knowledgeable, really just enjoyable conversation. So here's part one of that, me and Chris Davidson. Before we really dive in, I guess we should determine how to introduce you. Chris Davidson, professor of...
recovering professor of biology.
Biology, okay. And then, and you're not entirely sold on the idea of like your students being able to find this online. So you might be like the Professor Mysterioso or something like that.
Mysterioso, yes. Yes.
That'd be
the
fun.
Man behind the mask.
Yeah, we've never on this show never had anyone that was a clandestine figure. So if you want, we can hide your picture from the website. You could be just a voice.
Or a question mark.
Or, yeah.
1960s style.
Yeah. And then you and I met very briefly at a party at Comic-Con, and I was doing, I guess, promotional stuff for Reactor, for Sci-Fi, and then you were, I found that odd that you were one of the press outlets, because you, did it even go out? Was the interview, did it end up anywhere?
Yeah, we published it.
You did? Okay.
Through I also work with Association for Computing Machinery, ACM, and they published it in their magazine called Computers and Entertainment, mm-hmm. as David Huntsberger, host of Reactor, the Sci-Fi Channel.
I see. Okay, so it did go, because I don't remember, like...
I didn't send you a copy because I didn't have your contact information, but I sent it to the publicist.
Oh, okay. Then they never passed it on to me or like any Shocking. Link or anything. Yeah, they had some weird snags there. It's good to hear you say that is also shocking, because to me it was... But I enjoyed our talk, and we ended up chatting so much more ahead of the interview about interesting things, and then afterward to have to talk about a television show felt kind of like empty. It just didn't seem as we were really getting into it about. I had read that article about I think it was University of Pennsylvania had gotten some funding, or maybe it was Maryland. I don't remember. I tried to look it up recently and I couldn't find it, but they'd gotten some funding because they had seen enough evidence to suggest that they could really nail down that speciation was on a clock-like schedule and could occur like every 2 million years, these huge jump ups in species. And so I just ran that by you, and then you knew, and I didn't know your background at all, so it was crazy.
Yeah, how this much is you knew. Part of the question mark in the Mysterians. And God bless you if you got that reference. Part of that is I work in many different fields. Uh-huh. ACM is computers, technology, engineers. I'm a basic scientist, biologist, and also mathematician. So they don't necessarily overlap. It's quantitative thinking either way. And then I'm also a writer and director. So wow. I kind of try to keep, although I'm blowing the lid off that now, I try to keep things as separate as possible.
Okay.
Just so they don't overlap. People don't expect me to know about biology when I show up at a Sharknado party. That's where we met, Sharknado 3.
That's right, yeah.
At the Sharknado 3 party, they weren't thinking, oh, he must be a professor scientist, mm-hmm. Which is fine because that's not what I was there as. I was there as a member of the press,
yeah.
to talk to the host of Reactor, mm-hmm. the upcoming host of Reactor. And then it so turns out that you love science, and I'm a science professor. So, yeah, we had a great discussion on mutation rates, genetic clocks, speciation events, mm-hmm. punctuated equilibrium, everything I'm sure we're about to get into again.
Hopefully, yeah.
And then after that, we talked about Captain America's shield, which was also cool but different.
Yeah. Yeah, we really, in a short period of time, ran through a lot of stuff. I remember the publicist kind of looking over, like, when are you going to get into the...
Yes, she was. She was really waiting for us to get to why we were there, yeah.
Well, I guess, before we get fully into it, finding out how you got... Can you say, or you want to keep it Mysterioso? You don't want to discuss what university you are recovering from being a professor at, or where you currently teach?
Well, I'm actually still part-time doing one class, so it's current. And obviously in the LA area, because I live in Santa Monica, mm-hmm. Mysteriously, of course. And science is my first love, so I always wanted to be a scientist or an engineer. And hence, I'm still working with ACM on the application technology side, basic sciences, necessary. It makes everything else possible. Mm-hmm. But then somebody has to turn it into something that's functional, usable product, which is where the computer engineers and programmers come in.
Mm-hmm.
And then the love for science fiction kind of grew out of both of those, because really, science fiction is really just science and engineering without any rules, or with rules that you make up.
I think that's probably my favorite thing about science, is that it so often gets associated with, like, well, you're pragmatic and practical, and you tested this hypothesis. But I think before you even get a hypothesis, before, like, looking out in that Einstein quote of how important imagination is versus anything else, and that's not the quote, but just the general sentiment that the imagination is so valuable, because in science you need to look at something and let your imagination work a little bit, mm-hmm. and then go, I wonder if I could do that. And so science fiction does a great job of, I mean, the course that we are currently on, and so many of the inventions that occur daily are things that were dreamed up in people's minds long ago. I mean, eventually when there are jetpacks, or when people are, if they're able to ever, I know teleportation is probably not realistic because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
And if it is, they would have to kill you to do it, and then reassemble somebody who might not even be you afterwards. So it would be your molecules, but would it be your essence or things that we don't fully understand? That's the thing.
Yeah.
You could, in theory, disassemble molecule by molecule, store it in an enormous database and reassemble it, but they would be disintegrating and killing you to do it. So if Star Trek transporters were ever real, in Star Trek science, they've looked at this a few times, they would be killing you and then cloning, more or less. Not in a biological sense, but a reassembly, physical and chemical sense.
Well, they always talk about the part of you that leaves would be left as this sort of goop as well.
Mm.
And I don't really understand that, if it's all just molecules that are, I really honestly don't understand. Anytime someone brings up a good example of, like, why, here's why hypothetically it could happen, I go, yeah, all right. And then as soon as someone says, here's why it'll never happen, I go, yeah, that makes sense as well. So, but the imagination part is there. The first person to ever dream that up and think, what is time? What if I'm already living 30 years in the future, and I'm just going through every step that that figment has walked, you know, footstepped in? I don't know if footstepped is a word. Or
yeah, it could be.
Yeah. Maybe.
Creativity.
So you're from Florida originally.
Well, I lived in Florida before I came out here. I'm from London, England originally.
Oh, no trace of an accent.
Hence the British accent. Well, I came here when I was a kid, so it disappeared in grade school. But lived all over. Mostly, though, being from London, I have preferred places with sunshine and or palm trees. Hence Florida and Southern California.
Yeah, yeah. And then you studied and got degrees and or a degree or and or degrees in what? I mean, to have the range that you have is pretty unusual.
Two in science and one in business, an MBA. And I thought the MBA was, after I'd finished my scientific training, biotech was really hot 10 years ago. And I wanted to go start a biotech company. But ultimately, I found out that I just enjoyed teaching more. It pays a fraction, obviously, of what you can make as an entrepreneur. But I wanted to love what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can love what you do and make a decent living, you're a lucky man.
What were some of your biotech ideas? I mean, are you still passionate about it? Or is
biotechnology,
like
10 years ago, I mean, it's still in its infancy. But what I tell my students is, if they want guaranteed jobs, biotech is the place to go. There are three levels of genetics. Molecular is by far the most profitable, because those deal with, ultimately, pharmaceuticals that will be bought by people. So if you work on organism-level genetics, patient-level, patients, certainly you can bill, you get paid through the healthcare system. Population genetics will bleed into what we're going to discuss a little bit later, which is evolution, speciation. But molecular, if you can make a drug out of molecules based on a gene that you discovered and or maybe even patented, you can make billions if it's a well-selling drug. Mm. So that's definitely where the money is. And I thought I wanted to get in on that, but then I quickly realized I'm much more on the population genetics side of things than I am on the molecular genetics side of things. In graduate school, basically comes down to, there's the lab bench people, and that's not really a derisive term, but it is a generalization.
Okay.
The people who spend all their time indoors, looking over microscopes, working with solutions, trying to figure out the exact drug targets for new pharmaceuticals. And then there are the organismal people who deal with ecology, evolution, botany, zoology, the larger scale, who are outside tromping through forests and swamps and seashores, trying to do big biology. And that's me. I'm more of a large-scale biologist.
Yeah, when
so
you...
I didn't want to train into the molecular. I had genetics background, but population genetics.
Because when you described your, you know, mathematics and biology and engineering, the things you're interested in, you strike me as... when you think of... I don't know who it would be who jumps to mind. I'm not well versed enough in scientists, but when you watch documentaries or like in that, the new Cosmos, they'll show, you know, someone coming up with here's how they had their moment, and a lot of times it's people, you know, walking along the Mediterranean, looking up at the stars, and they go back to a lab or an office area where they have a telescope and some microscopes set up, and they're just really taking in the world and examining it from every angle they possibly can, walking out and understanding how the wind stirs butterflies up, and then watching how the leaves move and getting an idea of, you know, cycles and math and migrations. And you strike me as someone that would enjoy that kind of a life.
Being outdoors, yes, and then coming indoors. I couldn't spend all my life working for Amgen, and I love Amgen, great company, or Solera or whoever. Being in a lab 9 to 5 under fluorescent lights, trying to understand things that I can't even see, it's not too abstract. It would just be a little too, for me, cloistered.
Okay.
I am more of a field biologist. So ecology and evolution, which are really the same thing, as we'll discuss, same thing over different timescales. But getting outdoors and considering what took millions of years to happen and what is happening now, that's of more interest to me than sitting at a lab bench and working with a gene for 6 months or a year.
Yeah, okay.
But there's a lot more money working with one gene for 6 months or a year. That's why they all have Porsches and Ferraris. I mean, yeah. God bless them. But that's just not what I wanted to do.
So you like getting the knowledge, and you don't like having to be like the tediousness of finding it, the kind of... Not to say that it doesn't become tedious when you're sorting through, but, you know, this is dumb because I think everyone that's interested in science, they just like those little moments of, oh, so that's how that works, or engineering, the same thing. And you feel like on a larger scale, there's more of that to be had.
Right. Yeah, big picture. That's the idea. If you're fascinated by molecules, even looking at how one side chain attaches or doesn't, or how one isomer makes a difference when it's fitting into a receptor in the body or it doesn't. That's the most fascinating thing in the world, and I'm sure that they love what they do as much as I love what I do. It's just for me, maybe I just can't think abstractly. I prefer things that I can see or that I can quantify mathematically. And my research, going back, was modeling large-scale ecosystems over 1,200 years to try and program in life, death, fires, windstorms, everything. Disturbances, and then see what the ecosystem, how it would evolve over 1,200 years. So that was my mathematical application to biology.
I did one of those in college, like a low-level version of that, an algorithm with probably like a dozen parameters, like the things you mentioned plus, you know, 3 or 4 more or something like that. There weren't a ton. And when you start thinking of the amount of things that you would have to add in to that equation and then adjust for the evolution and cycles of things that naturally occur, it gets so daunting. And yet, when you think of people that are pursuing that one unifying equation that like defines the entire universe, do you think something like that could ever happen?
Back in the dark ages, like 10, 15 years ago, it was called grand unification theory, GUT, and then became theory of everything, hence the movie, which I loved. FYI, everybody, if you haven't seen Eddie Redmayne,
he was very good
as Hawking, he was amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
And just as a brief sidebar, he said that he would shoot 3 different stages of the disease in one day.
Wow.
As an actor, to physically prepare yourself and to execute 3 different stages of a physically debilitating disease, I couldn't even imagine doing that. I mean, that's just as a performance, as craft, that's fantastic.
And who blocked up all those shooting schedules? That sounds...
I don't know, but they tested him. I mean, normally they'd say you're playing him at 30% progression where you can still move, you can talk, but you're slurred. And then in 2 weeks, you're playing 50% progression. But they had him playing 10%, then 55%, then 72%, and then 10% again on one day.
That's crazy.
Because they had no budget. I'm sure that's what it was. They had to use the location.
Did you see
Daniel Day.
But he seems to be on the same stage throughout almost the whole movie.
Yeah, that's how you can tell the low-budget films is they shoot in one location. Because they can't afford to get 10 different ones. Yeah. So every new scene, you're thinking, damn, that looks familiar. They just got the set dresser to go in and change it a bit, or they lighted it differently. But they don't have more than $8 million.
I recognize
so
this.
I know that guy. He was in the shot 20 minutes ago. Right.
That's the same bathroom.
He's wearing a different hat. Yeah. It is almost like theater. You do what you have to do. But necessity is the mother of invention. And circling back to a theory of everything, and again, I began in math and physics, but that was a long time ago, so if what I say is dated, I apologize in advance. But from what I've been reading, and I try to keep up with it, the problem is that there are four fundamental forces. Three of them we understand fairly well, but gravity is a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
To unify gravity with the other three, weak nuclear force, strong nuclear force, electromagnetism, is at the moment not really even conceivable because nobody understands what gravity is. Particles, waves, in theory, it's simple enough. It can bend space and warp time.
But actually
experimentally try to observe it, other than the fact that things fall toward large masses,
mm-hmm.
it just seems to be beyond our understanding at the moment.
But our understanding on a large scale, we can rely on it. We see how light moves, and
sure,
we understand.
In classical mechanics, yes.
Yeah, and yet in the small scale, it disappears, and almost like, yeah, that must be so frustrating for those scientists that are trying to count on it, and then going, where in the hell are you? Where'd you go, gravity? At what point does it just disappear? Where on that spectrum? In whether it's size, or is at some point you're looking at something going, yeah, gravity has some impact or influence here, and then by the time you get to the atomic level, it's gone.
That's when the nuclear forces become more powerful, mm-hmm. right? They attract each other, and then if you get even smaller, then when you get into quantum mechanics, that's when all the uncertainty comes in, spooky action at a distance, pairing and things like that, things that Einstein was dismissive of.
This might be a dumb question, and sorry to jump in there, but in thinking of that, gravity is here and we know it and it operates this way, and then down on this other end of the spectrum where it is no longer around, because we know those two ends of it, is there a search to find where there's a cutoff? Is it a graph where it moves linearly? Is it some sort of exponential thing? Is it a limit where it just plateaus out? And because if you could find that, then couldn't you integrated into one of those theories of everything or equation of everything?
Well, gravity still operates at the small scales. It's just that there's so little mass that it has no effect, almost no effect, so a negligible effect.
Okay.
And the other forces within the nucleus or near get stronger. So there is still gravity for anything that has mass, even something as tiny as an electron, but it's a negligible effect compared to other things, electromagnetism, positive, negative, etc. As far as the break, between classical Newtonian mechanics and quantum, there is. Yeah, it comes down to size. So gravity gets weaker and weaker as the mass of whatever body becomes less and less. And as you go more toward the nucleus of an atom, the nuclear forces get stronger, or the interaction between atoms gets stronger if you crush them together,
mm-hmm.
like in fusion.
Yeah.
If there's enough gravity to crush atoms and force them to merge, they will fuse, which we're trying to do on Earth, but we have to spend so much energy to make them fuse that what we get back is maybe break even.
Okay.
We just don't have enough mass. The sun's mass, we can't replicate. And what I mean by don't understand gravity is, if we could figure out, Star Trek again, if we could figure out what gravitons are, for lack of a better term, gravity particles, and then control them, we could have flying cars.
Nice.
Like we're supposed to have. It is 2015.
Yeah, let's do it.
But physicists are slacking, no offense, because they haven't figured out gravity yet. I mean, it's 30 years since Back to the Future said we're going to have flying cars.
Yeah.
And still, we don't really understand gravity, much less be able to control it through engineering. So until the basic science is there, the engineering is not even, that's going to be science fiction, will remain fiction.
Is it difficult for you to understand the world on that fundamental kind of a level, then look at things via biology, and then examine maybe cultural evolution, and have a general understanding of, well, this is probably how the planet was created. Here are how more or less most of the molecules and atoms and things within it operate. And yet, do you feel like you have a good understanding, or are you still totally baffled by the world?
Completely ignorant, which is something I had a realization. When I graduated college, I felt like I knew everything, like a lot of college graduates do. When you're fresh out of school, you think, I'm so smart. I know this, I know that. And then my first day in graduate school, my professor, who saw my the gleam in my eye. He sent me to the library. He said, I want you to look up all the journals in our field. And it was three bookcases full. Mm-hmm. And I looked at them, and I was confronted by my own amazing ignorance, because I realized how much there is to know. And this is even 10 years ago. There's much more now. I realized that I didn't know diddly, to put it politely.
What if the amount you needed naive to know and never ignorant. Increased?
Well, that's it. You can't not be ignorant in the truest sense, because there's so much to be known. Mm-hmm. All you can even do within one field of biology or chemistry or physics is try to understand your specific area as well as you can. And then, like you say, in broad strokes, try to keep up with other areas. But I always had, among the basic sciences, physics, chemistry, biology, which lead to each other. Physics creates chemistry. Chemistry, 3.5 billion or so years ago, led to biology. There's a somewhat of a disdain for the social sciences because they're much more qualitative.
Yeah.
And then I did my MBA, which is business is a social science, mm-hmm. economics, all those things, management, organizational theory. And I realized how much they need to know about humans. Understanding molecules is not easy. Cells, tissues, organs, the brain, for example, is much more difficult. To try and understand how millions of people work together is nearly impossible. And when I did the MBA, I gained an appreciation for social sciences and what needs to be known and what isn't known. The best that they can often do is describe behavior. Mm-hmm. But they can't often make predictive models, because what any one individual person is going to do is often unpredictable. So I have the highest respect for them since I did the MBA, just dealing with how much needs to be known and isn't yet known. Mm-hmm. And in biology, for example, there are probably 10 or 15 million species on the Earth. We've named 2 million of them, roughly. Mm-hmm. We're guessing at the larger number, but let's assume that it's 20 million.
Okay.
That would mean we've identified 10%.
Yeah.
Which means we're 90% ignorant. And again, I don't mean ignorant in a negative way.
Right.
Just the truest sense of not knowing what is to be known.
Yeah, yeah. Whew. And it's got to feel weird to, like you said, like have a specialty. And you have a few. So you've kind of dabbled in, if you were to look at it like a single desk or a beaker or anything you could gather and organize and look at and kind of fundamentally understand on a level, whether it was the fluid in that beaker or every element you had on this desk, and you would look at it and go, I've got that sorted out, I've got this organized, I know how this works, I think I'm getting somewhere. And then you look up and realize the desk is an endless ocean. It goes out to the horizons in every direction. It would just, I mean, you, it's the safest thing, I think, to go back to that desk and just kind of keep working there and go, well, I know a lot about what's in front of me, I know a lot about this, but no one, it's weird to hear you, who just in our brief conversation, a lot more educated than the majority of people. I hope that's not too flattering or makes you uncomfortable in any way. But, you know, I mean, you run into a lot of people that have things solved, and I think they don't have that fundamental awareness of, like, I know such a tiny amount. And so, I mean, do you, because you saying like the social sciences, so things mm-hmm. like sociology in general or philosophy, do those weigh in? Is it hard for you to deal with people who just think the way they were raised and haven't really wandered outside of that comfort zone?
No, I think that's almost a default state. To have certainty brings comfort, and I'm not a psychologist. I'm just speaking on behalf of myself. To know that you know something makes you feel comfortable in that knowledge. You feel secure in it. Not everybody's a huge fan of uncertainty.
Right.
And to be aware of the fact that we're all profoundly ignorant of what there is to be known is not a pleasant thing. It wasn't a great day for me in the library when I realized that I know almost nothing. And that's 10 years ago, and God knows I've been studying hard ever since in all these different fields. I still don't really know much.
You go kicking your heels up and racing out of there. I know almost nothing.
Yeah, it was humbling. Even now, as I learn more about different areas, I realize how much there is to be known. And it's just fantastic. I mean, the amount of research that's being done, the new possibilities for new products and services that are going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years is amazing. So it's very exciting. I mean, it was humbling the first day I realized when you come face to face with your own ignorance, then that's a good thing, was a healthy thing, mm-hmm. which I recommend to everybody. But then it gets exciting because you realize this is great.
Yeah.
You know, I could spend my whole life learning and still not even scratch the surface. So it's a kind of an exciting forward-looking kind of a thing.
And that, I mean, like referencing being in, say, a library, looking at the stacks of books and knowing that in 10 more years, there'll be even more. And so if you had some sort of baseline to start with, if you're into cultural evolution or some place where it would all make sense. Oh, yeah, of course, 10 years from now, this makes sense to me that we would get there. But if you start from a place where you're just kind of dropped from a plane into that and then go, oh, no, I need to learn everything that's happened up until this point, and then I've got to keep up with it as it goes along. That could be, and really is, I guess, if people wanted to do that, so daunting and so overwhelming.
It is. And that's, I began in math and physics. What attracted me to biology was I didn't understand it. Mathematics is easy, and I don't mean that as any sort of a humble brag. I just mean there's a certainty to it. You can prove things in mathematics, proofs. I mean, people do that in middle school, in trigonometry, whatever. You can construct, or algebra, you can do proofs. You have complete information. You can prove something. When you get to science, you can't ever prove anything. You can fail to disprove it, mm-hmm. which I know sounds semantic and stupid, but you can gather evidence for it, like evolution by natural selection.
Yeah,
you can
gather gravity.
Evidence for hundreds of years, but you can't ever prove it. There's always going to be one possibility, the whole black swan argument, where you could somehow disprove it. It's hard to imagine that in the case of evolution, but you keep the door open. That uncertainty in science, in my opinion, magnifies greatly when you go to social science. So I have the highest respect for anybody who tries to understand humans individually or in groups, because honestly, in the traditional division, biologists deal with almost all those 2 million species other than primates. Mm-hmm. Primates is really the purview of the anthropologists and the sociologists and the psychologists, and certainly humans are. So I know more about evolution of other species than I do about humans, because I'm a biologist, not an anthropologist.
Okay.
So training in from math and physics, I didn't understand biology. And then when I went to the social sciences, I really didn't understand those, and I gained a whole level of respect for people that try to understand it. It's not easy, to say the least. And a lot of it's intuitive. They can't quantify it, which is where the disdain from basic scientists and mathematicians comes in. If you can't quantify it, it's not science, which is really an ignorant thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
I used to say that a lot. But if you don't have enough information to describe the variables, you're never going to parameterize the variables. And therefore, you just have to do experiments, be intuitive, gather information, and do what you can do.
And that, I mean, and I think about that less frequently, I would imagine, than people who are in the sciences. But are those things science? And I guess by what you just said, you know, you're applying your a hypothesis, you're attempting to gather some data. It's not as quantitative, it's not as tangible even, but you can kind of go, well, you know, we've studied this many people, we got their responses. I know a response isn't exactly the same as like a titration or a mutation or whatever, you know, a genetic thing where you could look at it. It still is a response that you have to mark down and go, well, out of this many people, 50 of them said yes, and so we have this data now, this collection. They could have all been lying. We don't know what's in the human brain. I can see where it would, a basic scientist, that's not science. I could see that, but otherwise, I'm inclined to say, like, if someone has some data they're trying to discover or a conclusion they're trying to get to, yeah, I think that's good to just lump it under, yeah, sure, it's science.
It is, and that's why I've been careful to say basic science. Social sciences are science. They use a scientific method. They observe something. They have a guess. Hypothesis is a guess. Educated guess as to why that something is occurring.
Mm-hmm.
They do an experiment, have a study to try and gather data, and then ultimately to test their guess, and then form a conclusion, my guess was correct, my guess was not correct, or maybe I don't know. So it is science if it proceeds by the scientific method. And PCB, physics, chemistry, biology, are simply the basic sciences, let's say the traditional ones. Social sciences are absolutely just as scientific. And another fallacy, which I learned in math pretty early, is that it doesn't have to be quantitative to be rigorous.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, mathematics is just logic with numerical symbols on it. But you can take, you said philosophy. If you study philosophy, you can take a class in logic and learn modus ponens, modus tollens, all those different formal arguments that don't have numbers on them, but they're pure logic.
Okay.
So mathematics, as at least to science, is just numerical logic. And people who have that kind of clarity may look down somewhat on those who are working with, like you said, qualitative responses. This made me feel good. I like that, you know, which is harder to pin down. But because it doesn't have numbers on it or isn't as quantitative, doesn't make it less logical or therefore less scientific.
Whew. That's hard to digest. But I follow you. Kind of to tie those things in together with like with your understanding and all these different pools and with a philosophical kind of drive to just look at it, to examine all of it that's happening and wonder, just from a human more than any place, to go, of course it would seem necessary if humanity is this kind of organism that you would have the explorers and you'd have the scientists examining why they got there and how they got there and where they could go and what things are made up of, and you'd have the builders, and then you'd have this general bit of the populace that was just kind of going along. Just regardless of what their jobs were, they weren't interested in those things. They didn't busy themselves with any of the thoughts with that. They had basic kind of lives. They took great joy in the most simple pleasures in life, and on and on and on. Every job, every place you would have, some people would consider themselves artists and be contributing to, like, what is this? Why are we here? Do you enjoy this? And when you look at that, all of these things combined together, the builders, the artists, the people who orchestrate things and administrators and on and every position and career, does it seem like an organism? Does it seem like it makes sense? Does it seem like it has a directive? Does it seem like pure chaos? I mean, what are your thoughts on that based on what you've studied?
Is there an overall, purpose, directive, etc.? There are 7.4 billion humans and climbing. I don't know that we have a common purpose or directive. And I'm not saying we exist merely to exist, that there's no meaning, that there's no point. I'm not a philosopher in that sense, or a theologian. Mm-hmm. But science has limits. Science, if something is testable, meaning you can gather data, test your hypothesis, disprove or fail to disprove it, then that is science. But as for larger questions like, is there a God? Mm-hmm. You have people like Richard Dawkins who publish books saying, well, because we understand evolution, there can't be a God.
Right.
Which is incorrect. I mean, he's a brilliant man, no offense. He did great work with Selfish Gene and mm-hmm. Blind Watchmaker and all these very fine publications. He's a very, very smart man who knows biology very well.
But he really goes after
But him. Sometimes, right, he overreaches, in my opinion. This is just now my opinion. He overreaches by saying, because we understand the mechanism of natural selection leading to biological evolution, there can't be a God, when, in fact, the question of whether there's a God or a point to existence is beyond science.
And if it's kind of irrelevant, right?
And right, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because when I teach evolution, my students sometimes will say, well, I'm Christian, I don't want to believe this evolution stuff. And what I tell them is, look, you don't have to believe one word of what I'm about to tell you, but you need to learn it and understand it and demonstrate that understanding on a final exam. And then after the final exam, if you walk out thinking it's all bull, that's up to you, because it's not my job to convert anybody or teach them what to think. It's just to teach them how evolution works. And if they choose to personally believe it or not, that's not my business. Like you say, mm-hmm. that's beyond science.
Well, as I got a tour of a history museum of natural science in Houston from this guy, I would consider a friend, Daniel Garson, very nice guy. And he said he had a professor who, when they brought up things like that, and not to say like evolution, but something that a rational person, not to say someone who had a preconceived notion via their upbringing or religion or whatever, but just someone looking at it just completely objectively and saying, wait a second, there was a dinosaur that weighed a ton, it had a 6-foot-long neck and a head on the end of it the size of a softball. How would that head have fed a body that big? And his professor would say, I have no idea, but I submit to you, it did happen. We have records, we have evidence there. We have enough to go on that this absolutely existed. It's baffling. It would just have to eat nonstop. And how did it grow this large? I mean, there are a lot of questions around that. And so I from that standpoint, is that kind of what you're saying to them? Like, you need to understand this and just know, like, this is pretty factual at this point.
Right. And when you say theory, people often use theory as meaning guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But in science, a theory, of course, is a hypothesis that has been tested repeatedly and has held up on balance of evidence, to use a legal term, or accumulation of evidence, empirical evidence, natural selection, biological evolution, for over 150 years has not been refuted. That doesn't mean we have complete understanding, and this is where another fallacy, logical fallacy, comes in. If you don't understand it 100%, then it must be incorrect. Well, that's just silly.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you can't understand something 100% because there's too much to be known to understand. But, and the whole black swan argument I mentioned before, just to briefly say, suppose you were an observer on a riverbank. This is philosophy of science. You're sitting on a riverbank, and every swan that swims by is white.
Okay.
For your whole life. You would conclude all swans are white.
Yeah.
Your hypothesis would be all swans are white. You would test it every day of your life. You would confirm it. You'd publish a book. It would become dogma. All swans are white. And especially if every other person on every other riverbank in other countries only saw white swans swim by. But you would not have proved it because one day, one person sitting on one riverbank sees a black swan swim by. Instantly, the theory that all swans are white is disproved. It's gone. Assuming that it was an actual black swan, it wasn't painted as a fraternity prank.
It was actually genetically
a black swan.
Nowadays,
then it is, you have immediately invalidated or disproved it. So that's why I say you can't ever prove anything in science, but you can gather centuries worth of evidence to say it's very, very likely. But there's still a possibility it's incorrect. There's always some uncertainty.
I think the black swan thing nowadays, with people aggressively claiming things and everyone shooting it down and finding holes in it, and it's hard to really decide on the information you're being presented with unless you're physically touching it, seeing it, going, all right, that is a black swan. It's really weird nowadays that amount of dissension and confusion is thrown into anything. If people came along and said, we found this particle. Ah, I don't believe it. It had to have this. Okay, it's back to square one. I like when, NASA had a press conference to kind of, here's what we found on Mars. Good day. Didn't let it kind of trickle out to the media. Just one, here's what we found. Everyone can tune in and see you later. We're not going to have it be something that, well, I heard this. I read it in a thing. This might have, because that's how this black swan thing, I think, would go. Someone would say they saw it. Well, that YouTube video looks a little hazy. I don't know if I buy that. That does look like a fraternity prank. All right. Well, moving on from that. I like that black swan idea that could still all the things we know could be thrown off just so quickly with the black swan
idea. Which is exciting.
It is.
It should be that when you publish something, a new discovery, that either heretofore unknown principles, or that disproves or invalidates something that everybody's believed for a long time, that's exciting. But it should be that every other scientist immediately tries to prove that you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it should work. Because ultimately, if they can't, then you're right. Or at least most likely correct. Versus cold fusion, the guys that said, we have cold fusion in a test tube.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody could replicate that, which is why we're not in the fusion era, like, again, Back to the Future. We were supposed to be. It would have been great if those guys, Pons and Fleischmann, had been correct. But they were pretty quickly disproved. As long as it doesn't get personal, science works by disproving things. But again, back to Dawkins, not to pile on the guy, but he does tend to make things personal and go after people and make declarative statements. Again, maybe a little bit too aggressive, but at the very least, he is doing his job as a scientist to try and disprove other things, whether he's successful or not. And all scientists should be trying to disprove everything else, especially if it's newer.
Yeah, I can understand his side to some degree, but I think he lacks a bit of empathy at times. And I think if you did get really chastised or even attacked for things that you found by people who considered themselves to be doing the Lord's work or higher powers work to really slam you, you would go, hey, I just presented my findings. And after you get attacked enough time, you start going, you know what? Not only am I going to stop tolerating this, I'm going after you now. I'm going to prove to you why your thing that you latch onto so tightly is wrong. To me, that seems potentially like where he is operated from, and I
and
get
a lot
it,
of
but
scientists do. Absolutely. Culture wars are hard to avoid when you're an evolutionary biologist, and he's a geneticist, but today that's the same thing. Mm-hmm. Genetics and evolution are quite merged together. If people are going to spend all their time attacking you for non-scientific reasons, I know some of my former colleagues the same way. they would teach a class on evolution and religion and set out to disprove why the Bible is incorrect.
Yeah.
Which is understandable and fine. But my personal opinion on that is, like you said a few minutes ago, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
Whether it's correct or it isn't. And I'm not trying to judge religion or anything like that or be political. But from just a scientific point of view, if it isn't testable, then it's not science. So I wouldn't teach religion in my science class any more than I would want them to teach titrating an equation in their theology classes. They're just different fields of endeavor, not better or worse than the others. They're just different. So I completely understand why many, especially evolutionary biologists, personally get into it, because they get attacked all the time. Mm-hmm. And some of the attacks are just ludicrous.
Yeah.
I mean, just, there's no missing link, so it must be wrong. Well, we gave up on the missing link idea 40 years ago, but thanks for playing. I mean, they're not even using current theory to attack.
Yeah.
And it is ludicrous, and I get frustrated as well, as you can tell. I understand where they're coming from, which is maybe why I try to avoid the culture wars altogether. But really, they are separate things. So when I've had students bring up those issues to me, and when I taught in the Southeast, it happened a lot more, I would just say, again, you don't have to believe it, but you need to learn it and understand it. And that's as far as we would go.
Mm-hmm. That is a thing I'd rather not get into, because there are so many sensitivities involved with it. And whatever people need to get through life, good. If you're being a good person.
More power to them.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't want to strip them from that. Like, no, this thing that's helped you be great to everyone around you and a delightful person, it's all fake. That seems crazy.
Absolutely agree.
And so, but what about the black swan idea? What if it's the first thing you find? What if the swans don't come by all that regularly, and you see one, and you go, I prove something. There are swans in this lake, and they are all black. And then years go by, and the second swan shows up, and it's white. And then the third, and it's white. And suddenly, so the fusion idea, things like that, what if they were... they did exist, but they were just this brief glimmer of, it was temporary. It was just an anomaly. We can't recreate it. That swan is gone. So how do we reckon with things like that?
That's the thing. For it to be scientifically valid, it has to be recreatable, repeatable. Mm-hmm. So when you publish, everybody else, how they set out to try and disprove it is, they try to replicate what you did. And if they can, then you are validated, supported by empirical evidence. If they cannot, either their methods were flawed, or yours were, or, as you just said, perhaps it was just random chance that you happened to observe something, some kind of fleeting phenomenon, which nobody understands. We don't even understand why we don't understand it, the unknown unknowns, which is great. I love that kind of, to me, that's exciting.
That's the best.
We don't even know why we don't know it, but we don't know it. To me, that's awesome.
The never-ending story. We don't even care that we don't care.
Yeah, I mean, because then you can spend however many years trying to figure out why you don't understand it, or you can give up and move on to something else. But either way, many of the great discoveries in science came when someone had, they thought they knew what was going on. They had a hypothesis they were fairly certain of, and then it was completely incorrect, or at least not at all what they were thinking. But they stumbled onto something really cool.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of leap forward.
Yeah. I like the guy who was discovered Pluto, got recognized for it, but then told his wife, like, I don't think this is going to stick. The guy from Kansas who would sneak in the lab. He worked at the lab, but he would use the high-powered telescope late at night and kind of chart movement and things. And he said, I'm seeing something here pretty regularly. I believe it's in orbit. And then they gave him, hey, you found Pluto. And then I think he said to his wife, I don't think what they think I found. And that, to me, is the ultimate science move, is to go, oh, all this adoration and acclaim should feel great. But what would feel better is knowing, being like absolutely certain, like this is pure science. No one can deny it. I found something that sticks.
Right. That's the scientific method. Of course, scientists are human. What should happen when someone comes along and disproves an existing theory, especially if it's been around for a while, with a lot of experimental validation, a lot of people have spent their careers researching, publishing, and or teaching that particular theory. What should happen is the moment that it's disproved and that disproof is validated, everybody should just move on. But people are still people. Scientists are still human. It's often hard to separate the personal and the professional for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so you, and I'm not a psychologist, but it seems to me if you believe something for many years, you're going to have a very hard time giving that up.
Yeah.
Just overnight. And as even just a very simple example of that for me, a very minor example in my life, I learned bird classification through what's called the old Wetmore system, Wetmore classification, which was based mostly on anatomy and things like that. And then these guys named Sibley and Ahlquist came along when I was in college, early 2000s, and they were molecular biologists, and they completely reorganized everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, wait a minute, a crane is not this, it's actually a shorebird, and it's a falcon, but it's not, it's a hawk, and just all these different things that made no sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd only learned the Wetmore system a year earlier, but I had a very hard time adapting to the new Sibley Ahlquist. However, the molecular evidence is far more powerful than anything based on bird skins or, you know, larger scale observation, so it had to be done. And I can't even imagine if I had believed in one thing for 30 years, being able to just give that up.
Yeah,
I don't see how anybody can do that unless you're a Vulcan. If you're Spock, you're like, well, that's not logical, and you move on. But
yeah.
For humans, we grab onto things, we hold onto them. Everyone does that.
As a country, I mean, look, we refuse to acknowledge the metric system. We're sleeping in Fahrenheit. No one else communicates with it. We have to do all these dumb conversions just because we like it and we're used to it. And the people that, as the masses, spoke up and said, nope, not going to change. Don't want to, too comfortable with this, which makes some sense. I mean, it would be weird if we were always open to change at all moments. If we existed as a country in a fully scientific capacity of every Monday, someone would come along and go, that thing we all thought last week, turns out we think differently now. And everyone would go, all right, we're open to it. So I think there's something viable about sticking to what you know, what you believe, and holding fast, but I guess within reason.
Yeah, the metric system is used by scientists. Certainly, even in teaching it in research, certainly use the metric system because it's based on tens. It's just easier to work with.
Mm-hmm.
However, not everybody uses it. Most people don't in culture. They use English units, but even in England, they don't really use English units. They use metric system. I mean, in Europe in general. So, yeah, the irony of it is that. And perhaps one of my favorite interesting examples of metric versus imperial is 15 years ago, I think late 90s, early 2000s, NASA had a space probe that they smacked into Mars, high speed.
Mm-hmm.
Long story short, the scientists sent all the instructions in metric. The engineers were using imperial units. And so it went in like hell fast. It's funny now. It wasn't funny at the time. But it went in way faster than it was supposed to go. Wait, that's kilometers per hour, not miles? Whoops. And it just pounded into Mars, and it was a complete and total loss. The people at NASA were not amused.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, 15 years later, it's funny now, because that is the whole thing. When you're not even speaking the same language, you get misunderstandings, to say the least. And probes that smack into Mars.
And it's just such a slap in the face to everyone considering math to be the unifying language supposed to connect us. Well, Chris, we haven't even gotten into the bulk of the series, dude. Our talk on speciation and what really introduced us to one another. So let's take a quick break and get to that. And we'll have more of this. We didn't even discuss this California Blonde Ale from Eel River. How are you enjoying it?
Delicious.
It's good, yeah. I like a blonde ale. So, all right, let's take a quick break and then chat more about that stuff. Man, isn't that guy smart? Stick around for part 2. We really get into speciation and what exactly that is and some thoughts and theories and drop some... It seems like every tidbit out of his mouth is just dripping with knowledge. Just got a lot of information, and he retains it really well and shares it very well. So hope you enjoyed that, and hope you'll check out part 2 as well, because it continues with Chris Davidson, Professor Mysterioso, and more of the Eel River California Blonde Ale. Let's get out of here, y'all. I want to say thanks for some donations. Nicholas, again, donated to the show. Thanks a lot. And Ben from England. I won't say London. I think he lives like a little bit out of town, but came to the junk show when we were there and had a DVD copy of One-Headed Beast and was happy to give him a poster. And he tried so hard to salvage the technical issues we were having and fix a projector, but it couldn't be done. But just a genuinely nice person, and so thanks for the donation. The beer in this episode provided by one of those two guys, and the beer in the next episode provided by the other one, I guess. And if you want to donate, it helps with offsetting some costs for buying beer for the show, And you can do that at thespacecave.com. The show is available on iTunes. If you don't like iTunes, I think you can get it on a number of different platforms now. But let me know if it's not available in the way that you typically like to get podcasts. Let me know, and I will sort that out. But it is on iTunes. All of my CDs are on iTunes. One-Headed Beast is streaming on Vimeo On Demand. You can find all the links to that at davidhunsberger.com. Thanks for rating the show and commenting and all that stuff, and just genuinely being nice folks. I feel like we're getting a good little group here together and a good little community, and it's been fun to share in these conversations with you guys and hear your responses and whatnot. So looking forward to a fun 2016 filled with more ramblings about what it is to be alive on planet Earth with all of us. And there are a lot of us here. Sticking with the, I think last week I played a song that was not really sent in, but just a song that I enjoyed. And this is in that same vein as well. This is from the Smith Westerns, who broke up, I guess like a year or maybe even 2 years ago now. A young group from Chicago that I thought was terrific. Hope they'll get back together. This is one of their biggest hits of the Soft Will. This is Varsity from the Smith Westerns. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave.